I'm going to move the mic to the side so I'm not standing right in front of the slides. Thanks for the invitation. As I move the mic, I'm clicking the button and going ahead of my slides, which is fine. I chose this topic and I chose the opportunity to speak tonight, partly as a way for myself to learn more about what I'm doing on my sabbatical. I have taught two courses at Gordon on cancer biology in the last 4 years, and but I myself have never actually worked directly in the cancer field until right now. And so previously I've worked in immunology, I've worked on viral evasion of the immune system, I've worked in cell biology, I'd say, typically. But of course, as you'll hear very soon, cancer is all about cell biology and basically why do these cells divide out of control and start to take over our bodies. So my outline here, I wanna talk about what is cancer, some of the mythology of cancer, then a little bit about the idea of cancer immunotherapy. What is it? And it's a little complicated. So that part is going to be, I'm trying not to get into too much depth, but give you the bigger picture of the big ideas of what's going on there. And then finally, we'll talk about some new tools that are being developed in the lab that I'm in now at Dana-Farber. And I'm happy to have my coworker and colleague, Dr. Jess Ingram here, who's actually done a lot of this work, and I'm just learning it now. So, you know, I'll probably make a few mistakes, and if I do, you can tell me later. of course, clicker isn't working. And this being a group of Christians in science, I would be remiss if I didn't mention some kind of aspect of how I feel this relates to the Christian faith at the end. And some of those questions are really not questions of science, but yet are very important and interesting. So, cancer. A lot of people think, you know, there's a lot of cancer out there right now. This is a new thing that's happening, but it's very old. In fact, the oldest case of prostate cancer found in an Egyptian mummy. So cancer is not a new disease. It's been around for a very long time, and I'm having issues with this clicker. Yeah, so cancer refers to non-benign tumor growths, right? So cells can start to grow out of control and you can have a little lump here and there. And if it's something that can be removed, it's early in its development, you don't typically call that cancer, but it's really usually when this happens, the cells that you'll see, they're on the way to becoming cancer quite often. So most forms of cancer arise spontaneously. In other words, not something you inherited, it's just a genetic mutation that occurs, while others result from inheriting a genetic predisposition. In the 1970s, papers were published on studying the mathematics of a very interesting form of cancer that forms in the eye called retinoblastoma. And by looking at the mathematical incidence of tumors in one eye versus two eyes, and thinking about the genetics of the situation, Knudsen was able to hypothesize that this was a defect that was basically caused by single mutations. When you have when you inherit one bad version of a particular gene, then you only need one mutation of the other version of the gene, the one good version, to get this disease. It has to mutate in the back of the eye during development, this little window of time. And therefore, the people, the children who had both eyes with bilateral retinoblastoma typically were the ones who had inherited one bad copy, and they had a much, much higher incidence of retinoblastoma. So this was the early inkling that there was some genetic thing going on. Things to know about cancer. Cancer gets worse over time. Probably you knew this already. So far, you may not have learned a lot of new things. But usually this takes decades of time. The most classical example of this occurs is been worked out for colon cancer, where very particular sets of genes are mutated over years of time. And so this is why colonoscopies are important. At a certain age, you have a colonoscopy. And what began as benign growth, once time goes on and further mutations occur, becomes invasive and can metastasize, spread around the body, and be a very, very bad thing. Things to know about cancer. Diet probably has very little to do with cancer compared to other factors, right? So many people think that what you eat is going to give you cancer or prevent cancer, right? Take those vitamins, take the antioxidants, alcohol, antioxidants, artificial sweeteners. There's a long list, and it goes down to garlic, tea, and vitamin D. All of these things have been studied, and none of these in randomized controlled trials have shown any kind of either protection or increased incidence of cancer. It doesn't stop people from making websites and selling books touting natural cancer treatments, such as this one. 10 treatments from Dr. Axe. I mean, treatments for cancer, right? And they're all natural, like including number 10, prayer and building peace. And there's a Bible quote for you from the website. A joyful heart is a good medicine, but a broken spirit dries up the bones. Well, I don't think praying is going to be harmful at all, of course, but it's probably not. I mean, they've actually done trials, and it doesn't actually seem to, in a randomized controlled trial, do a lot. Yeah, that's an interesting question, right? Why is that? How does God work in the world? These are these theological questions creeping in here. Cancer myths abound. How many of you have heard that sharks don't get cancer? You've heard that? Yeah, a lot of people have heard that. Well, they do get cancer. It's just not true they don't get cancer. In fact, clams get cancer. Contagious cancer, these are my clams I dug. They can get clam cancer, right? And it spreads through the water, and they filter it out of the water. It lodges in their gills, presumably, or wherever they filter the food, and it starts to grow, and then they get cancer, all right? So all up and down the phylogenetic tree of organisms, they get cancer. This is the worst thing ever. This guy, unfortunately, he lived in a poor part of the world. He had a tapeworm. He also had immunosuppression. He died of tumors, and right around the time, like maybe just after he died, they figured out what these tumors were. They were from the tapeworm. They were tapeworm cells that had figured out how to grow out of control in his body because he was immunosuppressed, presumably contributed to the fact that he, was unable to control those tapeworm tumor cells. And you can see there's lungs are riddled with those tumors. Very unfortunate. So, yeah. Cancer is a genetic disease. So we're all born with normal cells dividing normally, and something happens, and then a cancer cell takes over your body. And it's not one cell, of course. It becomes a mass, and it can, take over your bloodstream. Liquid tumors like lymphomas and leukemias, they can take over your bloodstream. Now, genetics or environment, both play a factor. As we saw with the retinoblastoma, smoking, yes, does lead to increased cancer. Anything in the environment that increases mutations will lead to more cancer. Is it one mutation that causes cancer or several? Several mutations. Many different genes can increase cancer. In terms of these genes, though, there are a limited number of pathways in the cell that are influenced by these various genes and gene products working in various pathways. So there's maybe a dozen or so key pathways that are deranged in cancer cells. So that gives hope, much more hope, to being able to do something about cancer if the number of pathways you need to manipulate are in the range of what you can count on your fingers and toes compared to hundreds and hundreds of genes that are involved. So strategies to combat cancer typically fail due to the fact that cells become resistant. This is illustrated here where you have your tumor, you go undergo surgery, radiation, or maybe chemotherapy, and then the tumor can be seemingly gone, right? And then a little time goes by, maybe a year goes by, and then you have a new tumor that is derived from a single cell, perhaps, that became resistant to that drug, right? And then that's the idea of drug resistance. And this happened early on. Sidney Farber the namesake of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, he discovered that you could mess up the DNA synthesis process and just really lower, just knock out leukemia in children with leukemia. But after 2 years, they were gone because they became resistant. So this is just like with bacteria, you have a single antibiotic, you get them antibiotic resistant, and they take over. Very similar idea. It's actually a microcosm of evolution going on in your body, a little bit of selection, very many cells being selected, one can escape and become resistant. That's trouble. Well, it's a good time to be, it's a good time to have cancer because a lot has happened since the 1970s when the original war on cancer was declared. You can't really see it well, but there's a picture of Richard Nixon with his head down signing the Declaration of War on Cancer, the National Cancer Act in 1971. It was an utter failure. There was no success right around that time because there was very much a lack of knowledge, a lack of tools to do anything about cancer. Now we're in the 2010s, and 2013 was declared on the cover of Science. Breakthrough of the year was cancer immunotherapy. And that gave me the idea to share this with you guys. Like, what is cancer immunotherapy? Like, is that really a great breakthrough? Why do people say it's a breakthrough? What's going on in that field? In fact, the other C word, for a while, cancer wasn't even utterable. You couldn't print it in the newspaper. You couldn't put an ad about cancer. It was not talked about. Now people are using the other C word, cure. For the first time, really, for some of these therapies. And there's been an avalanche of knowledge in biology, as you probably are aware. We have cheap DNA sequencing. You can take a single cell now and do the entire sequence of that DNA of that cell and determine, say, which proteins are mutated in one single cell. That's a new thing. That's amazing to do that. We have transgenic mice where we can take a suspected cancer-involved gene and delete it from the mouse. We can put another gene in. We can make a mouse have human genes and do human studies in mice on human proteins. Lots can be done with mice very easily today. We have cancer-specific cell lines that replicate at least some aspects of a natural cancer. I went to a talk, I think it was 2 weeks ago, where the fellow spoke about how a tumor cell line behaves one way in this plastic dish. You put it into a mouse, it behaves differently. You take it out, it goes back to the original way, and back and forth, back and forth. So there's a lot about cancer that we still don't know. But we have learned a whole lot since the 70s. You can order a gene online, which we do in our lab quite often. We'll say, oh, we need to make this protein. You type it into the computer, send it away, and about a week later, you get this gene. In a little tube, it's DNA, and you can clone it, you can express it in cells. It's amazing what you can do. I went to another talk recently. This is one of the great things about the sabbatical. I get to go to all these talks. There's so many great talks in the longer medical area. One of the talks I went to recently is, why does chemotherapy kill cancer cells? It's not really the subject of this talk, but it's not what you think. It's not because they divide rapidly. Other things about cancer cells that make them especially susceptible to chemotherapy, which is really interesting. And so, of course, we'll get to the alpacin antibodies at the end. So I was going to show you this little video. It's kind of an inspiring video about this young girl, Emily Whitehead. Carl June and his colleagues, a bunch of colleagues down at University of Pennsylvania, have sort of pioneered this particular kind of cancer immunotherapy, which involves taking cell, well, we'll talk about how it works after. Just let's watch this 3-minute video together, shall we?
I'm a summer person. You can do more fun things. We're going to the beach. I'm not scared of the ocean. I'm not scared about much.
She was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia in May 2010, shortly after her 5th birthday, and she ended up relapsing while still on treatment. I had heard about immunotherapy just kind of generally in the news, and so I knew that that's the way cancer therapy was headed.
what we're doing is trying to develop a way to attack cancer using the immune system, to genetically engineer T cells so that they can now recognize and kill cancer cells. When Emily came to us, the clinical trial opened pretty much at the moment that she needed it. She was a first patient, which of course is a scary thing for parents to sort of contemplate that their child was going to be the first patient on a clinical trial. There was a lot of unknowns.
We knew chemo wasn't going to work. We tried something different. This is, you know, groundbreaking, something that we need. Within 5 minutes, we said, go get the consent. Can I film your reading?
Come on, let's do it.
Can we shut it off? She said, I'll keep fighting if you don't leave. So she said, whatever they do, you have to stay here and keep touching me. I said, okay. So I said, all right. So Dr. Alexis said, okay, it's going to be pretty tough to watch, and we're going to have a lot of doctors coming in. We have to work on her past to save her life. It worked. There's no cancer in her system at all.
We have come to the end of our ride, it is true. But there still is a lot you can learn about you.
You learned something incredibly important from Emily, and we have applied that to many other patients since then. We've treated over 30 kids with ALL. 90% of these kids have gone into a complete response. There is no evidence of leukemia in their body.
What would you think if maybe tomorrow we just got up, got in the car, and went to Nemacolin?
Yay!
Do you want to go?
Yeah.
We're going.
Cool. Nemacolin is my favorite place. We had gone there once when I was sick. It's a place where there are lots of animals. I love animals, and I want to be a veterinarian. I'm going in the fourth grade. My favorite age is probably 9. That's because I am 9.
She was literally the poster child for cancer immunotherapy, and it really worked really well for her and for other patients, like they mentioned in the video. This is for ALL, which is a certain kind of cancer that it's derived from a certain kind of cell, B cells, which you know, you can target the B cells by targeting molecules that direct the T cells to the B cells. So let's see. So nothing can be done. She was at the end of her rope. These patients most of them have relapsed several times, and there's nothing more that could really be done. So what they do is they take out the T cells from they just knock down the T cells from the patient. Now, T cells are the kind of cells that are often involved in directly killing tumor cells, just lysing and causing them to die. So you take out the patient's T cells, and then you introduce a gene into the cells in tissue culture. You take out the cells, you introduce a man-made gene, which is modified to not only target and bind to the B cells and kill them, but it also has activation domains inside the cell. Basically, it's a special protein that just changes the T cells to strictly focus on those bad cancer B cells. So, they can actually kill thousands of cells. One introduced cell can kill many, many cells. And it's capable, apparently, of dividing and maintaining itself in the body after the tumors are gone. So you have this permanent memory of that lasts into the future. So once the cancer cells are gone, what I've read is that they typically just use antibody replacement to make up for the lack of B cells, because it actually kills off the normal helpful B cells, the antibody-producing cells, the body as well. So that's an interesting side effect. Now, the thing that you didn't see in the video is that she basically almost died from the therapy. It's really dangerous. What happens is all kinds of, as the T cells are starting to go to work, there's a lot of death and destruction going on throughout the body, and you can imagine all the substances that are being released, all the cytokines and chemicals being released that cause fevers, the blood vessels can become porous, the lung can fill up with fluid, the kidneys can fail, all kinds of things can happen. So they were able to give her they noticed that the levels of IL-6, which is one of these cytokines, was elevated. They were able to give her another drug to block that. And actually, that's part of the standard therapy now when there's an extreme reaction, to give that to knock that down. But you don't want to knock it down too much, because actually that process seems to actually be part of what actually makes it work. So this is something that works well for the liquid tumors really well. Not going to work as well for solid tumors. So that's one of the other things you won't really hear necessarily unless you look a little bit deeper into it. Another strategy for immunotherapy, now we're transitioning into the immunotherapy part, which I'll try not to get too technical, this is an example of blocking an inhibitory signal that is being given to T cells. So here we have T cells, and they are getting a signal, as you see here, to turn on the T cell through this molecule, CD28. CTLA-4, this other molecule, comes up a little later and tells the T cell to turn on. Now, what you can do is block the CTLA-4 with an antibody, and that pulls away the CTLA-4 negative signal, rendering the T cell more active. At least that's the theory of how it works. It may not be as simple as that, right? But this is one of the ideas. So the general concept of checkpoint blockade or checkpoint inhibition is to block a negative signal to a T cell so that it becomes more active and then can fight the tumor. That's the basic idea. So there's the cover of Science I mentioned. Molecule in. Oh my goodness! Terrible, terrible, right? Look at the complexity here. This isn't even that bad. It gets much worse. So this is from a review from 2011, Cancer Immunotherapy Comes of Age. It's actually a very good review. Summarizes the complexities of what's going on. So I'm going to highlight three aspects of this. First, cancer vaccines, then we'll talk about adoptive T-cell therapy, and then antibody therapies. So cancer vaccines, what they're trying to do is activate the T-cells, sort of educate the T-cells. Remember, these are the tumor-fighting cells. Give them some, say, peptides, little proteins from the tumor, so that they'll then recognize the tumor and fight it off. That's what's shown in the upper left. So immunization, this idea of immunizing. This was done with prostate cancer. You may have heard of something called Provenge. They had a particular protein from prostate. They fed it to dendritic cells from the patient. And the hope was that those dendritic cells would educate T cells and fight the tumor. And guess what? It worked only so-so. Didn't work that well. It hasn't really been a great bonanza of success. You would agree with that? Cancer vaccines. But it's a strategy that combining cancer vaccines with other things could be a potential thing to keep working on. Adoptive T cell therapy was what we just learned about. Now, those special T cells that had a new gene added to them were called chimeric antigen receptor T cells, also known as CAR T cells. And like I mentioned, they work pretty well on leukemia. You can also come up with molecules that you can inject and protein molecules that bring the T cell together with the tumor, just direct it to the tumor. So one end of the molecule binds to the T cell, and one end of the molecule binds to the tumor antigen. And just getting them together and say, here, T cell, there's the tumor, go to it, right? So that's another strategy, bispecific T engagers, or BITES, E-I-T-E. Basically working at that level of the effector T cell response. And then we have antibody-based therapies. Immunosuppression being reversed by these checkpoint blockade molecules. That's down here on the lower side. So you see a molecule there called PD-L1. We'll talk a little bit more about PD-L1 later. PD-L1 is expressed on certain tumors and elevated amounts on tumors, and we're using that as a way of directing T cells into the tumor. So So this shows another figure, a similar figure I showed earlier with the CTLA-4 pulling away, being pulled away by this blocking antibody. All right. So see, this is these doctors will say this. It rolls off the tongue. Ipilimumab, right? Ipilimumab, and there's all these mumab names, and mab, the suffix refers to monoclonal antibody. So if you ever hear a drug that ends in mab, now you know it's an antibody, all right? That's an important thing to remember. All right, so these anti-CTLA-4 is one of the classics that seems to have some effects. We'll look at some data for the PD-L1 in a second. So again, remember, liquid tumor versus solid tumors, they are not as easy to fight with these tools. So the new tools in cancer research we're going to talk about next that we're developing, not that kind of tool. Okay, this kind of here. So we're going to switch now and talk a little bit about alpaca antibodies. By the way, that was an ice cutting tool that I got recently. Proud of it. So why alpaca antibodies? So we know that we have this anti-CTLA-4 that works, this PD-L1 system thing that works. Those are conventional antibodies. They look sort of like that. They have two chains, a heavy chain and a light chain. I don't know if you can see that. So the binding site for antigen is at the top, with a little bracket. It's made up of two different polypeptide chains, two different genes. It's a little bit of a challenge to isolate the DNA for that, because you have to isolate two different pieces of DNA. And you can't just take all the cells and get the DNA and isolate it, because you have to get from one single cell, right? Because every B cell has different heavy and light chain genes, but they're activated together in that one cell, producing that special antibody that you want. So it's hard to clone, to isolate a native antibody, a regular antibody with two different genes encoding its specificity. And plus, if you want to make a full antibody like that, it's not as easy to make that in bacteria, to produce that protein in bacteria. On the other hand, camel family, including alpacas and camels, have heavy chain only antibodies. Now, not all of your antibodies are heavy chain only, but a certain fraction of them are. And the ones that are, we can very easily clone that little blue end part. And that alone binds to the antigen. So it's very small, all right? And binds very tightly to the antigen, and maybe even more tightly than some full double chain antibodies. And we can express that in bacteria. It makes a very handy little tool. A little bit more on that in a second. So this is a summary slide that I got from Jess, thank you, showing the anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 checkpoint blockade molecules. And you can see that they're interacting with signals that, see the little minus there? That's giving a negative signal to the T cell. It's giving a negative signal. So by blocking that, it's activating the T cell to reactivate immunity. In many cases, in immunology, your body makes an immune response and then something happens to knock it down, like with HIV. You do make antibodies against HIV, but then the rest of your immune system starts to fail and they're not sufficient to protect you. But if you could reactivate that immune system the immune response you've already made, that's the idea behind doing this. So again, on the anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1, this is some data that was published. And I really do have to walk over and point to this. But these curves show over a period of months on the lower axis the number of survivors, all right, under different treatment regimes. So what we have on the left is anti-CTLA-4. And so which of these curves would you want to be on? This one or this one? The upper one, right? The upper ones are the survivors. 25% survivors, which is not that great, right? But without the treatment, they would be down here and they would be pretty much gone, right? Unfortunately. So the treatment had a big effect. Now, I heard back, I asked a question to Stephanie Dugan's husband, who's an MD, PhD. He knows the latest. Like, this is from 2010. He said, these people that are leveled off here, you're still alive today, and they have no detectable melanoma. They've been literally seemingly cured from this treatment. Plus, a lot of them get other treatments as well, but it's the additional treatment that antibody that did something. And here you can see another effect where you have a similar kind of thing. This is nivolumumab, I think it is. Nivolumumab. It's an antibody against PD-1, and these people are leveling out, whereas the control group is not. So antibodies can influence the progression of disease, in this case melanoma, which is a solid tumor. So working on, trying to understand this, exactly what's going on, trying to combine different antibodies would be an approach that we want to do. We're also working on creating antibodies that can target into the tumor and maybe carry in an active molecule, a cytokine, directly into the tumor, and seeing what that would do. So here we are back to our camelid antibodies, and this is what we end up with as our useful compound. It's the little the tip end encoding the antigen binding region, the part that binds to your target protein. We call them BHHs. They are single polypeptide chain. They fold up nice and tightly, and they have loops that are all on one end that bind to the antigen of interest. Monomeric. So these have been used in humans in a particular disease, which is hard to pronounce, but it has to do with blood clotting disorder, and it's a anti-von Willebrand factor antibody that prevents platelets from aggregating. And so these have been tolerated in humans, so that's a good thing as well. If you put a large antibody in from a foreign species, you're likely to make antibodies against that antibody as a foreign antigen, and that can interfere with the success of the therapy. Oops. All right, so how do we make these antibodies? How do we make these camelid antibodies? A couple times a month or so, you go out to Western Mass and bring some antigen, a mixture of antigens, all right? You can immunize with not just one protein, but maybe 40 proteins, right? So in one animal, right? And then you wait a period of time till they mount an immune response. You collect their lymphocytes, meaning blood, right? They don't have to die, they don't have to suffer. And then this is the part I'm hoping to learn in the next few weeks, actually. I haven't done this yet. But you amplify the particular BHH gene segment, part of the cells that encodes that little BHH gene, and you stick them into a circle of DNA that will then be expressed on a virus, a little tiny particle of virus. Then you float those viruses, each expressing different specificities, in a dish, I presume, plastic dish? Sure. Yeah, or beads. Beads, there we go. Onto a solid substrate, and you select, you pull out what you want, and basically then you have your DNA of interest, and you have this gene that you've isolated. And this picture of a little guy getting his blood drawn, his head is being held firmly, so he's not going to injure himself. But he didn't seem to mind very much. He's a he. Didn't seem too bad. That's about as bad as it gets. So we have, in the lab, we are working with this particular BHH, this particular antibody called B3, which binds to PD-L1. We've been talking about PD-L1 and LFA-1 and so on. But PD-L1, it goes in and it concentrates in the tumor. So on the left side of this animal, is it ventral surface? I don't know. On one side of this animal, there's a tumor, and it lights up. So this is a PET scan, so that these BHHs actually do home to the tumor, which is great. Having a molecule that will go into a solid tumor is truly remarkable. So we also have modified these by combining the BHH with a linker to, in this case, IL-2. And you end up with a functional IL-2. Part of doing this, you have to show that IL-2 is still functional. IL-2 is a powerful powerful substance. This is one of the most basic cytokines. And if you were to inject someone with IL-2 systemically in the bloodstream, they would feel horrible, right? It was a very powerful stuff. All this is going to be like you have food poisoning, basically. But on a small scale, between cells, it activates T cells. It activates the immune system. So we want to bring this into the environment of the tumor. And so by combining the IL-2 with the B3 in a mouse model of pancreatic cancer, you can actually see tumor shrinkage. And there it is, right? The B3 by itself and the B3 IL-2, there's a major difference in the size of tumors after 30 days. So one of the first things I did when I came to the lab was witness the PIs, Stephanie Dubin, do this surgery. It's amazing. Take the animal, this mouse, anesthetize it, pull out its pancreas, bloop, inject it with cells, put it back in, sew it up, staple the skin. It's a beautiful thing. 30 days later, you have tumors. And so you can do this over and over again with these various compounds to see, you know, which ones work and which ones don't work. Combinations. It's an amazing system to be able to, you know, study solid tumors. So there's different models of pancreas cancer. They have a couple different kinds of cell lines. So, you know, we hope that they replicate what really is going on in a regular pancreatic tumor. But it's a very good start. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So getting near the end. So there's a lot of things to do in the future, as I mentioned. So I thought I'd talk about, some faith aspects of this whole cancer thing. I think this brings up the issue of death. And, you know, the idea of death before the fall. I read an entire book on this where someone was critiquing the beliefs a lot of Christians hold, that there was no death before the fall. I think things like cancer make me at least reconsider the idea of not only death before the fall, but disease before the fall. And what is the fall? I mean, this really causes me to re-examine the theological questions in light of the idea that, gosh, there's no inkling or evidence that cells have really changed their behavior in the last, say, time since humans came on the planet. That's where I'm coming at. You know, and yet Jesus wept at the premature loss of his close friend Lazarus. You know, death is a sad and unfortunate thing. There's no doubt about that. And Jesus healed people, right? So as we know how cells work, to me it seems unlikely that cells in principle can avoid cancer. Like, I think cancer is a necessary byproduct of cell biology and how we know cells work. You know, which would be a troubling concept and maybe a challenging concept to accept if you have a view of the fall as sort of introducing, say death and disease into the world. And on a larger scale, this fits as well with that notion that physical death is necessary for evolutionary change to happen, for new creations to come about. Death is part of that equation. So that's a troubling aspect of these kind of thoughts, if you will, with people's conceptions. So the hope that I can't explain, right? This is the non-sciencey part of the thing. Somehow God will overcome death, and that's sort of pretty clear in the scripture, I think. Christ seems to indicate we'll be with him. Resurrection is a thing, right? So, I don't try to explain that logically, and I just kind of, it's hard. It's a hard thing to understand, I think, trying to come at it from science. So the person of Jesus, to me, weighs kind of doubts about these issues of resurrection and so on and so forth. So, and I think the key message of the gospel is that, you know, God, through Christ, provides strength and power right now in our lives. It's not some kind of future necessarily thing only, but also right now. So these are the kind of faith and science questions that I work with, as mentioned, with pastors during the summer. I've had two cohorts of pastors who talk about these kind of issues. They learn about science, and I think it's good to have questions, discussions over difficult questions like this. No amount of science is going to answer these questions, and yet I do think science at times raises questions that may cause us to re-examine our theological understandings, and that's a healthy thing, I think. So, for future reading, I recommend this book strongly. This is a great book. Sid Mukherjee's book, believe it or not, he was in Hitler's lab as well. It's just a fabulous book, given right up to date, kind of talk about cancer and the whole history of what happened and how we learned about cancer. And then if you want a really more detailed review of cancer, there, Hanhan and Weinberg have Hallmarks of Cancer, The Next Generation, published in Cell. There was one in 2000, and this one came out in 2011. And they list several hallmarks of cancer, and the two new ones, one of them includes immune evasion as a hallmark of cancer. So these are, immune evasion is one of those things that gets worse over time. The cells are selected to become more and more cleverly able to avoid immune detection. This is Jess and Rain Dance and Pitta and Milo. Now, this is Itaplu is the PI, the principal investigator that myself, Jess, and Stephanie Dugan all were postdocs in his lab over many decades of time. So, and then this is a picture of Jess and Stephanie at the MFA recently as well. So I want to thank the opportunity to share with you all. And I wanted to try to leave time for questions. I haven't been looking at my watch, but hopefully there's enough time. Oh, yeah, good time. So, yeah, thank you for your attention. Lots to think about, for sure. Kelly has a question.
So, what do you actually inject the alpacas with?
Is it a form of cancer? Nope, it's an immunization.
Take it out and hold it.
Yeah, good idea. So the alpacas are immunized, which is exactly what happened to me last week. I was immunized. They injected some flu antigens into my arm, and now I'm making anti-flu antibodies. So we inject, you know, PD-L1 or VISTA or these other proteins into the alpacas. So somebody has to go through the work of purifying specific proteins for us to have as immunogens, as stimulators of immunity, stimulators of B cell production, antibody production. So, and Jess was telling me, like, not all the animals have quite as robust of an immune response as others. It's just like people. You know, you hope that they're making antibodies, and you also boost them. You don't just give them one injection, you give them, like, a second injection. And, you know, over time, they build stronger and stronger immunity. It's a good question. Yeah, Randy.
So you seem to say that cancer is somewhat inevitable, or at least sooner or later you're going to get it. It could be. I don't know anything about this.
Everybody gets cancer.
So a few days ago, New York Times was this article about raising the issue of whether there is an absolute limit to human lifespan, you know, that really caps. Is cancer one of the reasons for that? That if you live long enough, you're going to get cancer?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So certainly anything that contributes to mortality is going to limit, on average, the lifespan of people. But I think some of the thought of those who want to extend the human lifespan is to be able to improve, say, DNA repair or boost the immunity. Now, boosting immunity is not always a good thing, because typically you want your immunity not to be boosted. You want it to be just at the right level. You know what I'm saying? You boost immunity, what happens? All of a sudden you have autoimmunity. And that one figure where the guy had all the rashes and stuff, that is a side effect of some of these treatments where you're reactivating T cells, you start getting inflammation around the body. So you really don't necessarily want to boost immunity. So how do you extend lifespan without having these other side effects occur? It could be a challenge. So... yeah, I guess the hope would be that, yeah, everybody will get cancer, but then we'll have the tools to
genetically sequence the tumor, know exactly which genes are wrong in that tumor, apply the exact right treatment, you're rid of that cell line, basically, that's in your body. And so therefore, you know, you're good for another 20 years until the next one crops up. But it seems to be the case that, like, over time, there's a lifespan, right? And over time, you have greater and greater incidence of like, the chance of you getting a tumor, I think, when you're between the age of 75 and 80 is much greater than the chance of when you're between 25 and 30, because we've accumulated DNA damage over our lifespan.
Yeah, so this, my intent was to bring you back then to your argument on death before the fall, because you kind of seem to indicate that if cell biology pretty well ran on the same basics as it does today, that eventually you will have this death occur. I mean, and you will have cancer occurring, and you will have death occurring. That was not necessarily 100%, but that the death would exist.
It
so that
there.
That kind of couples together with that, right?
Yeah, there has been, of course, you know, there's no evidence that there's been a time in history when critters didn't get cancer, nor is there evidence of a time in prehistory when viruses didn't exist, when, you know, it's disease, all that stuff's been around since life's been around. So it basically, to me as a biologist, shows kind of a naive, uninformed view of the biology when people assume that there was no death, no disease, at, like, you know, maybe 100,000 years ago. That doesn't jive with biology at all. So you have to really go back and just work on theologically the meaning of those passages, mm-hmm. I think.
Right.
Yeah.
You run into the problem of what Paul's argument is in Romans chapter 5. In verse 12, he says, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin. This implies clearly, from Paul's point of view, that death didn't exist before Adam and before the fall. And so biology...
Well, I'll say what's clear...
I think this book is inspired.
Yeah. However, there's no way of escaping the fact that you are interpreting those very words, right? And that, you know, others interpret it differently. I'm not saying it's not true, but trying to get at a meaning of that which is compatible with this. Because you know, this kind of knowledge is not, it's not, say, infallible word of scripture. Well, you know, it's not that kind of knowledge. But on the other hand, it's very weighty in a scientific sense, in other words. So what I try to, the approach I try to take is to say, all right, rather than sort of doubting the science, let's just assume that it's right, not just assume it's right, but understand why there's so much evidence that this is right, and accept that truth with a capital T from science. And if it conflicts with our interpretation of the Bible, then we should really say, well, what did Paul mean when he said, you know, death through one man? Did he mean physical death? If he did, then he was wrong. Is that even possible? That he could be wrong about an aspect of that, whereas the greater theological truth stands. All right, so there's a lot of subtle ways of kind of attacking that scripture versus a kind of plain reading English understanding. You know what I'm saying? I think you can
the
scripture.
I think you're trying to make something more complicated than it is. Romans was written in the trade language of the day. It wasn't written in some classical Greek. It was written in the Koine Greek, which was the everyday market language, which was more akin to pidgin English than, say, the classical language.
Yeah, so if Paul
so
says...
When he talks about death, I mean, I can get up my Greek if you like, and we can look at it, but...
So this brings up huge issues with Adam, right? Yeah. It brings back, like, the historical Adam question, and I think these are issues that people need to wrestle with. I don't think you throw out the entire truth of Jesus Christ by reinterpreting what is meant by Adam. I don't think that's necessarily, that doesn't follow from that. You know, there's variations of the historical Adam question from an actual atom in a population, right? Or, you know, there's various ways of interpreting that. And then there's the theological way of interpreting what Adam means theologically as the same archetype representing humanity. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, rebelling against God, falling, fits with the need for a redeemer, the need for redemption. I don't think you have to, you know, stick with necessarily a single, you know, single Adam or a historical Adam. I think there's flexibility there. And, I mean, from my perspective, things from science do push up against that kind of traditional view, which we've had for a long time. There's been a lot of theology has never been static and fixed throughout history. It's always over history continually been refined, winnowed, and maybe sharpened. People used to think, you know, the Bible said this, the Bible said that, and then, you know, the earth is not the center of the universe. You know, they used to think it was based on an interpretation of scripture. So we have to be careful about that. A lot's been written on Adam, by the way. Books have come out, many, many books. And I don't think we need to fear looking into these books, fear that we're going to, you know, somehow lose the core of the Christian faith. But this is the difficult discussion, right? I mean, it's very difficult. Because we've, you know, read the Bible a certain way for years and years and decades, and I kind of like it that way. I don't want to change it. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah. Brim.
If cancer, I mean, if you're saying cancer existed before the fall, what do you think it would have looked like? Like, would it have been without pain? Is that possible?
I don't see. I think the issue of the fall is something that we need to really work on from a theological point of view. I think it possibly could be understood at different levels. But, you know, yeah, I don't think someone having bone cancer before the fall would be not painful. I think it would be just as painful. So, like I said, I don't think there's any reason scientifically to think that there's been kind of a quantum shift in how things work in the world. Although that's, I think, the view that many Christians have. They kind of assume that some huge change occurred. And why do they think that? Because it seems that way from the scripture. It does seem that way, at least the way it's been read and interpreted.
This is a good time to put in a plug for a recent issue of the journal. I think, was it the June issue that was devoted to different interpretations of fall and original sin and how it yeah. all couples together. So
you would have no reason to.
March or June. It could be the one, yeah. I'd have to look at the detail.
You know, we should thank God for the science, because otherwise we would have no reason to, you know, reevaluate. Maybe our narrow understanding and kind of broaden our understanding of a deeper meaning of fallenness or a state of being fallen, and where does that come from? And, you know, yeah, is it a byproduct of some kind of freedom that we have? Yeah.
Well, just to interject, we actually are in a Sunday school class right now that's tackling Adam, and one of the books that the presenter is using is by Carl Bart, and he presents three different ways of viewing the Genesis account. One is historically, so like strictly a historical event. The other one is Carl Bart's construction, which is called saga, which tends to look at more of a theological meaning behind the event and what God is trying to reveal about himself. And the other is mythology. So I know that there's tension because people don't want to like throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there are theologians who've even struggled with it even before they've known all the science that is, you know, kind of swaying them in one direction or another.
Yeah, this idea of saga is like, it's hard to put into words. I mean, it's a German word, S-A-G-E. It's like pre-history. It's like you basically take it for what it says and then do theology with it. So what are the theological implications of this saga that we have? Not worrying about, you know, he doesn't even want to talk about the historical Adam question. He kind of got that out of the way in the first two classes. I'm like, oh, we're not going to talk about that anymore. Now we're going to do theology based on the scripture and move forward from there. He just got his PhD from Oxford, too, so he's very smart. Pete Anders, my friend. So, and he said himself to me that he's a theologian. He said, an evolutionary understanding totally changes like a lot of theology. It just does. It forces us to reevaluate our theological questions. Yeah.
Body construct we worked on together. Looking at the black box where you put something into the alpaca and then you get something out. Is there something inherent about a single chain antibody that makes it difficult to put into that construct, or is it an option? Is there like potential there?
Oh yeah. So what we were doing in the lab was figuring out a way to take the two chains, heavy and light chain, and combine them into one polypeptide chain to make it easier to express that molecule and try to retain its bond characteristics. But this, with the alpaca antibodies, it totally makes it even easier because you don't even need to clone two things, just one, right? So you have this little molecule that has full antigen binding capabilities. So it's really like sort of made our technology kind of obsolete. But the reason our technology that we're working on is useful is because and you can go directly from human B cells and take single B cells, single antibody producing cells, and then have a chance of actually cloning that more easily, facilitating the cloning of a particular antibody from humans or perhaps from mice. So.
What if you don't have an alpaca?
Well, you can find them. They're around.
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
So help me understand this alpaca thing a little more. You said, I think you said some of its cells are this special
yeah.
kind
I'm not sure the fraction. It's not. Is it not?
It's not 100%, right?
I think 10% of IgG1.
Yeah. So it's a minority of the B cells.
So, all right. So it's only like 10%. You have to pick those out. So why do camels and alpacas have it? What advantage? What evolutionary advantage does it provide?
Sometimes things just happen. In biology, you don't know why they happen. They just happen, and then they're like that for the rest of the time.
Mm.
Right? That's sort of the way the process works. And I think these antibodies have an extra long loop that helps them maybe bind more tightly, and so maybe that outweighed any other disadvantage that might have.
Hmm.
But it works like a regular heavy chain antibody. It has the same kind of signaling. And,
but as far as you know, it works pretty well the same as the other kind. I mean, there's no real advantage that you know of, except to you.
The animal, yeah.
Except to you doing this research.
I'm not aware of any advantage, although others that are more experienced may know of an advantage. I don't think any advantage has been shown from these antibodies. Yeah, no.
I mean, it's a fascinating question of why.
Yeah.
So sharks also make a very similar thing. So it's two species that have independently made.
Mm. Oh, so why don't you go out to sharks? You can get them.
Well, I thought about doing that.
Yeah.
You
go swimming with the sharks.
You get more blood out of an
alpaca. Yeah.
They don't bite.
Cuter, yeah.
But I was thinking like little sharks, like those little ones in your fish tank. You can maybe use those. Grind them up, okay. Get the cells out.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So there were three or four, maybe three New York Times articles on immunotherapy,
yeah.
Cancer immunotherapy in the last year. I didn't use any of that material, but it's been in the news. It's a really hot topic right now. And the war on cancer is sort of finally starting to have at least a hope of being fought with some effectiveness. Every tumor is different, but we can now sequence them and figure out exactly how they're different. We can do that. That costs money, but it's been cheaper. So there's all these things that are happening now to give a lot of hope to people.
So are there certain types of cancers that are more amenable to this kind of treatment than others,
or is
everything?
They're all different. But you want to find generalized treatments that work on a lot of different kinds of
yeah.
tumors. So like these kind of checkpoint things, because they interact with the T cells, that's the common thing that's in common with a lot of tumors is T cells can work on them. So if you can work on the T cells, then that may affect large numbers of different kinds of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So. But like the Emily Whitehead thing, that's very specific to a very particular kind of B cell tumor. But it almost proves the principle that will then allow further development of other
yeah.
chimeric antigen receptor CAR molecules. Yeah. By the way, they put them in. How do they get them into the cells? They use a a virus similar to HIV virus. It's like the same kind of virus. It transduces into the cell and inserts the DNA into the cells so that they can then, you know, have that integrated in the genome of those T cells. So there was all this talk about how they used AIDS to HIV. They used HIV to cure cancer. Really, they didn't. They just used the tool, the vehicle, to put the DNA into the T cells. Yeah. All right, thanks. Do you have any other questions? I'm around for a little while longer. Okay.